We're doing Baba Metzia Nun Chet Amud Bet. And the Mishnah says, Kishem Shona B'mekach U'memkar, just as a person can be afflicting, can be harmful, illegally in his purchase practice and in his sales practice, Kachon Abed Varim. So too, a person can be afflicting, can be harmful, in the way he speaks. Lo yomar lo b'kama chefet zev u'ino rutze likach. A person should not tell a seller, how much do you sell this for, if he's not interested in purchasing that item. Im haya bal tshuva, if someone is a master of tshuva, lo yomar lo zcho ma'asech harishonim. You shouldn't tell him, you remember what you used to do, you remember when me and you used to go do X, Y, and Z. Im u'ben gerim, if a person comes from a lineage of gerim, lo yomar lo zcho ma'asech avotecha. You shouldn't tell him, you remember what your grandfather used to do? Sh'ne'emar v'ger lo tonu v'lo tonev v'lo tilchatzenu. As the verse states, do not afflict a ger, do not oppress a ger. Teno Rabbanan. We have a... We're on Nun Chet Amud Bet in Bab Metzia, at the beginning of the Gemara. Lo tonu ish et amito. Huh?
Where?
The middle of the page. The beginning of the Gemara. Yeah? Did I give you Bab Metzia? Nun Chet Amud Bet. Nun Chet Amud Bet. Tanu Rabbanan. We have a Tanakh quote that has good sources. Every time we have Tanu Rabbanan, it's an introduction for a Tanakh quote from Ravina or Ravashi from Beis Medrash that we can rely on their quotes. Lo Tanu Ish Et Amito. The verse states, do not afflict your fellow man. The Torah is warning us not to afflict in the way we speak to someone else. So the Gemara goes back and forth, and the Gemara says that that's the correct understanding. And then the Gemara says we shouldn't remind people what they did. The Chochmat Adam, the Ochot Tzadikim, says that an application of this would be if someone's sitting in the room and that person is blind. So we shouldn't say, you know how annoying blind people are, even if we don't mean him. And it's going to be clear from what we say that we don't mean him. Says the Ochot Tzadikim, we shouldn't even mention a blemish that someone else has when he's in the room. Meaning if I start talking about blind people, the blind person automatically feels everyone's looking at me. If I start talking about, I'm scared to give an example because I don't know what's relevant to whom. But any time we're going to discuss a fault, anyone that has that fault automatically assumes that you're talking about them. So the Ochot Tzadikim says one of the sensitivities that we're supposed to develop is not to even mention something which someone might consider a fault. To be a ger isn't a fault. It's an asset. Nonetheless, to make mention of it can cause someone pain. If a person was a ger, im haya ger, we're holding by the little gimel in the beginning of the line, about 10 lines up from where the lines get wide. Im haya ger, uba lilmod Torah, if a person was a ger and he comes to learn Torah, al yomar lo, a person shouldn't tell him, pesha achan valim trifot shkatzim umasim ba lilmod Torah, someone who ate non-kosher is going to come learn Torah that was given from God's mouth. Im hayu yisurin bein alav, if afflictions, someone's getting punished, things are going bad in this world. Im yuchalein bein alav, o shaya mikavert banav, al yomar lo keder shamru lo chavarav leyov. If someone is having a difficult time in life, his children, God forbid, pass away, he's getting ill, he shouldn't tell him like Eov's friends told him, "Halo yiratcha kislatecha tikvatcha v'tom drachecha zchorna mihu naki avad." Our sages are telling us that the condolences that Eov's friends told him, their condolences were improper. Now, what exactly, how Chazal meant, we're supposed to understand this verse can be understood that Eov's friends were telling him, you didn't get this if you didn't deserve it. Must be that you're everything you're doing, at the end of the day, we see, if this is what's happening to you, you deserved it. So on the one hand, part of Nichum Avelim, part of what we're doing when we're comforting a person for a loss, is we're helping him reconcile the fact that God is running the world and yet something bad happened. So that's part of the concept of Nichum Avelim, to help a person philosophically come to terms with it. On the other hand, to give him this solution and tell him, well, you deserved it. God doesn't do things if we don't deserve them. So that's, according to some understandings, that's what the Gemara is going to preclude. That's not a way to comfort someone.
So we're forbidden.
Hmm?
That we're saying we're forbidden. From
yeah, that's
saying.
That's
we
one of.
Yeah.
Right. Right. That's one of the ways to hurt a person that the Gemara says is included in the biblical prohibition of not afflicting with words. Let's skip down to the last words in four lines into the wide lines. Amar Rav Yochanan Mishum Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. Rav Yochanan quotes Rashbi, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. Gadol onat dvarim onat mamon. Affliction with words is even greater than affliction with money. If you cheat someone, you overcharged him, that's not as bad as if you hurt him with your words. Shezeni emar bo, v'yaretam elokecha. Because when it comes to afflicting one with words, the Torah adds, and be a God-fearing person. God is watching. V'zeh, oh, pizza's here. Shalom. So the Gemara says that afflicting with words is greater than afflicting with deeds. The Rabbi Lezer says that afflicting with words is worse than with money, because zeh begufo v'zeh b'mamono. If we hurt someone with words, we've hurt him in his body. And if we've hurt him with money, so we've hurt him with money. My grandmother has an expression in Yiddish, a patch vergessen, a volt vergessen nicht. If someone smacks you, so you could forget it. No, he got upset, he hit me. But if someone says a bad word to you, you'll never forget it. But, when someone hurts us with their speech, that's something we don't forget. Rabbi Shmuel ben Nachmani amar, Rabbi Shmuel ben Nachmani says, why is it that hurting someone verbally is worse than monetarily? Zenitan li shavon, v'zeh lo nitan li shavon. Money, if you cheated someone, you could pay him back.
You didn't sign it?
What? I didn't sign it? Sorry. And if you take money, good thing you checked. If you take money from someone, so that you could pay him back. But if you hurt him with what you say, that you can never take back. Thank you. Tani Tana Kamed Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak. We had a Tana quote in front of Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak. Kol mabim nechavro barbim kilu shofech damo. If someone shames someone in public, it's as though he spilt his blood. So, Amar Lei, so Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak told him, Shaper Kam, that's a good point you made. Dechazin alei de'az yisum kavati chivra. Because when a person gets shamed, his face turns red, and when the blood leaves his face, he turns white. There are two stages to shame. First person turns red, and then he turns white. Tamar bichanina, akol yordin legeinom chutz mishoshara. Bichanina taught us. Everyone ends up in perdition except for three. Akol tzarkadai, tachimin, everyone, eleim akol yordin legeinom olim. What it means is all that go down to perdition end up coming up. Chutz mishosha, except for three, shiordin men olim. They go down to perdition, they never come back up. Veiluhen. Haba leshet ish, one who commits adultery with a married woman. Vamalbin pne chavro barabim, one who shames his friend in public. One who gives his friend a bad nickname. Mechane haynu malbin. The Gemara says that's the same thing. You're giving him a bad nickname, you're embarrassing him. Afagav didash be bishmei. Even though he's already used it, he's used to being called that name, he fatso, he's used to being called a nickname that he doesn't like.
Yes, what time is it there?
Even though every time you call him that name, he doesn't turn white. Nonetheless, if a person means to shame him, so that the Gemara says is part of it. You guys take. We'll continue. You guys aren't working with the text. Amar Rabba Bar Chana, Amar Rav Yochanan. Rabba Bar Chana quotes Rav Yochanan. Noach lo l'adam sheyavo al safek eshet ish v'yalbin pnei chavro barabim. The worst thing a person can do is to shame someone else. It's even worse than a person committing adultery with a married woman. How do we know this? And this is going to refer to the Gemara with what we just finished learning with David HaMelech and Bathsheba. My dichtiv, the source for this is what Rava taught us, that the word the Rava learned from the verse. Uvitzal'i. The Gemara says a person should rather if a person shames his friend, it's worse than if he committed safek adultery. If he went with a woman that it's in doubt whether she was married or not. And if you recall, when we learned the story of Bathsheba and David, we discussed a big machloket Rashi Tosfot. Why Bathsheba was considered safek eshet ish. The whole concept of the get that David left her. What kind of get it was, maybe we'll get to it later. Yeah.
How come we speak about a friend?
How come?
We speak about a friend.
What do you mean?
A friend normally doesn't do that.
Ah, Pnei Chavero Barabim. So I think there's a place where the Gemara says that why do we call him a friend? Because he's someone that should be your friend. The Gemara says it about somewhere in the Torah, that the Torah discusses if a person does something improper to his friends, so the Gemara says, well, if he's your friend, how are you doing that? So the Gemara says, it's kind of, he should be your friend. So, we're referring to him like, the guy who should be your friend. Often we have that. The Gemara says that when we use a term to describe someone, we're describing the relationship we should have to him. So Rava derived it from the following verse. David HaMelech says, "Uvetzali samchu v'nesfu karuv lo damu." Amar David lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. David HaMelech is saying in this verse before God, "Ribono shel Olam, Master of the World, galuv yado lefnecha shemiyum karim sami besri lo hayad mi shotet la'aretz." They embarrassed me so much that it was as though all my blood had left me. If they would have torn me to pieces, my blood wouldn't have spilled to the ground. They were in the middle of learning a totally different concept. They were learning a Mishnayos out in the laws of purity about what kind of blemish makes tzaras, what kind of blemish doesn't make tzaras. When you have a dead person in a tent, how far out does it go? They were discussing a totally different topic. I'd walk into the room, Omrimni, they'd say to me, David, oh David, welcome to the Beis Medrash. We have a question for you. Habale shetish mitato bima. If a person goes with a married woman, how do you kill him? They weren't learning that topic. That's a verse in the Torah. They don't need me. They're asking me a question because they're looking to shame me the second I walk into the Beis Medrash. V'ani umer lahem, and I answer them, mitato b'chenek v'yesh lo chelek la'olam haba. He gets killed with strangulation. If he was warned, then he did it nonetheless. And nonetheless, he has a portion in the world to come. But if one shames his friend in public, he does not have a portion in the world to come. So this is the source that we're quoting, that one who shames his friend in public does not have a portion in the world to come. Malzuto Bartuvia Amarav, we have a quote in the name of Rav, and some say it was a quote in the name of Rav Shimon Chasida, and some say it's a quote in the name of Rashbi. Noach lo la'adam she'apil atzmo le'kivshan ha'esh v'al yabim p'nei chavro barabim. A person should rather fall into a burning furnace than shame his friend in public. This we derive from Tamar. That when Tamar, you recall the story that happened between Tamar and Yehuda, and they came to Tamar and they asked her who bore these children, and Tamar didn't answer who bore the children. Tamar said, the person who owns these, he bore the children, send it to the great Rabbi Yehuda and tell him that's what I said and see what he says. And the Pasuk says, he mutzet, she was being taken out to the gallows, she was being taken out to administer the death penalty. Vehi shalchal chamiya, and she sent word to her father-in-law saying, you want to know who has fathered these children? The one who owns the signet ring, etc., the staff. Amarav channa b'reid ravidi. So she didn't say, he fathered them, they're his children. I was with my father-in-law. She didn't shame Yehuda publicly. She said, whoever owns these, he fathered them. And then she left it in Yehuda's hands to decide what to do. But she wouldn't shame Yehuda publicly, even though she didn't know if the executioners would wait with her death penalty till word got back from Yehuda. When the Torah says, do not pain one his fellow man, this is a reference specifically to someone who is keeping the Torah. If you have someone who is what we call an apikores, so then there are certain laws that don't apply. This is a special mitzvah with regard to the Jewish people. Meaning, the Torah forbids us to steal from a non-Jew. The Torah says there are basic social laws that apply to the world, and we're responsible to them, and non-Jews are responsible to them. But then there are fringe benefits to being part of the Jewish people. if I'm part of the Jewish people, so I'm supposed to get my loan without interest. I'm supposed to give my loan without interest. I'm responsible to do both. I'm not allowed to accept a loan with interest. I'm not allowed to give a loan with interest. But I'm allowed to take a loan from a non-Jew and pay him interest. From a non-Jew, I'm allowed to pay interest too. That's how we take loans from banks. By the same token, I'm allowed to give him a loan with interest. It goes both ways. Yeah?
What I do when someone owes me money in a certain time and he doesn't give me, what I have to do?
Oh, it's a good question. What can you do? You can take him to court. The courts will take his car. The courts will take something else. He should pay by that time. And if he doesn't, then you have a way. The courts have ways of taking the money out of him, if there is a way. Ideally, if you're going to enter that situation, so take a mashkon, take collateral, take cosigners. If you want to give someone a loan, so you should have insurances. There is a heter iska. There are ways of making it permissible that we become partners in a loan. But that's a little bit complicated, but it's also feasible. Meaning, if let's say I want to open a business, I need to take a loan from you. Right? So you're going to lend me $1 million. I'm going to start my business. I'm going to purchase X amount of merchandise. I'm going to purchase a warehouse. What we could do is there's a form of a contract in which in that contract we agree that you have a partnership in the business. Meaning, I owe you $1 million. And now what we're also writing into the contract is that you have a partnership that you could take from the business X amount of the profits. So if I'm going to make, let's say, $100,000 a year, I have to pay you back the loan, plus you're allowed to take $3,000 a year as your partnership in the business. And that's one of the ways that we get around this prohibition. So we say you're not taking interest, you're taking your rights as a partial owner of the business. But that's, you could look, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch quotes one form of this contract. You have to realize that there is a risk involved, because if this is a contract and the business goes under, let's say there was only merchandise, there wasn't a building, so then even though the person won't be able to pay back the loan, you might not be able to collect that added amount that you were supposed to get. We shouldn't call it interest, but let's say you were supposed to get on your loan $1 million, you're supposed to get $30,000 a year, right? Let's say, right? Now, let's say the business goes under, he still owes you $1 million. But because the contract was written up that you're a partner in the business and you're getting it from what the business makes, if the business didn't make money or if the business went under, you might not get that. So you have to see there are different versions of this contract. There are different ways you could write it up. So by the same token, this concept of being extra careful, the concept of Lashon Hara, the Torah tells us you have to be careful what you say, because in the long run this may cause someone damage. If you directly cause someone damage, that's part of damages. If you're about to get a job and I go to someone and say, don't hire him, he's a lousy good for nothing, I speak badly, that's directly damaging him. That's not Lashon Hara. That's already direct damaging. Lashon Hara is when I say something which directly, it's unclear that there's going to be repercussions of damage. But it's something negative which could lead to damage. So there the Torah says, between Jews, there's extra responsibility. I'm not allowed to say that about him. He's not allowed to say that about me. And just like a non-Jew doesn't have that responsibility to me, I don't have that responsibility to him. This halacha falls under that category. Lo tonu ishet amito. So the Torah says that responsibility is dafka am shitcha b'torah mitzvot. Amar Rav, lo'olam yadam zehir bonat ishto. Rav teaches us a person always has to be careful with regard to afflicting his wife. Shemitoch shedimata mitzuyah onata kova. Because her tear is more easily found, so too transgressing this prohibition is more common. What does this mean? It doesn't mean that they're crybabies. It means that they feel things more easily. By us, it would take something more hurtful in order for us to reach, let's say we're going to measure hurt, in order for me to be hurt, a number 10 hurt, someone has to say something that weighs 50 pounds, let's say, in measures of hurt. By a woman, you say something that's only slightly hurtful, her scale is going to shoot up to 10. She feels things more easily. Her tear, it's not that they tear more easily because their tears are worthless, they tear more easily because their feelings are more sensitive. So because they tear more easily, we're taught that we have to be more careful in not paining them. Amal Birazal, Rabbi Elazar taught us, Miyom shenechav Beit HaMikdash nimnalu shari tfila. From the day the temple was destroyed, the gates of prayer were sealed. As the verse states, Gam ki ezak vashaveh satam tfilati. Daf api shari tfila ninalu, shari tmot lo ninalu. And even though the gates of prayer were sealed, the gates of tears were not sealed. Shneimaz, the verse states, Shimat tfilati Hashem shavati hazina. Listen to my prayer, God. When I wail, listen. El dimalti al techrash. Do not be silent when you hear my tears. When it comes to tears, God doesn't even have to listen. They're right before Him. So tears, that's why our sages expanded also that on Yom Kippur. Whenever a person cries, then that goes straight before God. And this is the concept also of a yosom and an almana, an orphan and a widow, that they tear more easily. They're in pain as it is. So even if when we add a small amount of pain, they'll tear. And God says, I listen to that tear. Anyone that listens to his wife's advice will end up in perdition. There was no one who was as bad as Achav, who his wife Izebel caused them to sin. So this is speaking about a wife like Izebel. Achav took a wife from Sidon, from the that tribe up in the north, and she led him to serve the Baal. So Rav Papa asked Abaye, people say, there's a common saying, if your wife is short, so lean over and whisper to her, talk to her on her level. Even if she's smaller than you, if she's talking, bend down and listen. You think she's shorter, you better listen to what she has to say. Good advice is that when your wife talks, bend down and listen. And we discussed that On Ben Pelet in our parsha, the only reason he was saved was because he was humble enough that when his wife said, hey, I disagree with you, he said, well, you're right. He shared with her his dilemmas, and he was willing to listen when she said she disagrees. So what do you mean that you want an easy way to hell, listen to your wife? So, lo kasha, habe midi dal, habe midi debeta. The first answer the Gemara gives is that it depends on whether we're talking about worldly things or whether we're talking about things of the world or we're talking about things in the house. Lishna achrina, and this is the way we usually go, hab midi deshmaya, if we're talking about heavenly things, hab midi dalma, things of the world. You want to know where to invest, you want to know how to run things in this world, take your wife's counsel. You want to decide things of the world to come, so that you're the one that should run the show. So there's a famous story of, I don't remember, I think it was Rav Salant, that he once said, when I was dating my wife, so we agreed based upon this Gemara, she runs all the things that have to do with this world, and I run all the things that have to do with the world to come. And we've been married 50 years, and we've been spending 50 years disagreeing about what pertains to this world and what pertains to the world to come. Why? Because there was a similar story about a Rosh Hashiva and his manager. That the Rosh Hashiva said with the manager, you're responsible for everything that has to do with this world, not responsible for everything that has to do with the world to come. So they'd have a question. What kind of cereal do we buy the kids? So the manager would say, well, that's this world. And the rabbi would say, what do you mean? It's a question of how they're going to learn. You better buy them a better cereal, something that will give them strength. That has to do with the world to come. So it's very easy to quote this, but to apply it is very difficult because every issue can be understood as in each one's realm. It's rare. You'll say, what home should we buy? Well, should it be close to yeshiva? There's pizza. You know what I mean? Should it be close to the yeshiva? Should it be close to the shul? There are many issues. Is it a home where it's more important that we have a comfortable guest room or comfortable children's room? Every issue can be seen through the eyes of the world to come, of this world. Amar Chista, kol sharim ninalim chutz mishare hona'a. Rav Chista taught us that all the gates can get sealed, but there are certain gates in heaven that never get sealed, and they are the gates of affliction. Shneimar hinei Hashem nitzav al chomat anach. God sends a messenger to take the task for any affliction, for any wrongdoing except for afflictions. The gates, the curtain before God, whatever that is, never gets sealed before those who get afflicted. So this is all leading up to the story that we're going to read about Rabbi Eliezer. That Rabbi Eliezer and the rabbis had a disagreement. If we make an oven, we know that things can become tameh, spiritually defiled. When things are attached to the ground and they're like karka, then they cannot become spiritually defiled. The Torah teaches us there is an exception, an oven. An oven is attached to the ground, a tanul, and even though it's attached to the ground, it can become tameh, an earthenware oven. That's a chiddush that the Torah taught us. Now, what happens when an oven becomes tameh? Yutat. Torah says it has to be broken. After we break it, it can no longer become tameh if we break it correctly. You have to break it into at least three pieces, according to one opinion. You break it, and then the bigger piece can still be used as an oven. So you break that bigger piece into two pieces. So now that oven can no longer become tameh. Now let's say you have an oven, so you have this round tent-like tanur. Tanur was built like a tent. It was wide on bottom with a big fire and thin on top. You cut it, it became tameh, you cut it, and then you cut the broken piece into two. So now you have three pieces. Now it's no longer tameh. You build it back together again, can become tameh. If you don't put tar over it, you just put one piece on top of the other, it's not yet an oven. If you put sand in between the pieces, so now you don't have a whole oven. You have one layer of an oven, and then sand, and then another layer, and then sand, and then a third layer. If you put sand, and then you put tar over the sand, over the pieces of the oven. So in that situation, it's a broken oven that's being stabilized to remain intact as a broken oven with the sand in between. Can that oven become tameh or not? So Rabbi Eliezer says it cannot become tameh. Even if you put a sheretz, one of the eight creepy crawly creatures in the airspace, it does not become tameh. And the sages say it does. And they had this oven brought before them, and they disagreed. Rabbi Eliezer said it's taho, and all the tuma and holy things that were made in it are taho, and the rabbis disagreed. They brought all the proofs in the world, and he wouldn't agree. He said, if the halacha is like me, then the carob tree that's growing next to us will uproot itself. And the carob tree got up and walked away 100 amas. He said, some say 400 amas. He said that you don't bring proof from carob trees. He said, if the halacha is like me, so then the stream of water that's running next to us will start flowing reversely in the opposite direction. So it started flowing reversely, and they said, that's no proof. He said, then if the halacha is like me, then the walls of the Beis Medrash will start bending as though they're collapsing. And the walls of the Beis Medrash started bending until Rabbi Yeshua yelled at them. Now, Rabbi Yeshua was his counterpart. Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer, we have Midrashim that tell stories of Gerim that came before them, just like the three Gerim that came before Hillel and Shammai. So even though this is two generations later, we have stories that describe that Gerim came before Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer, and the same thing happened. Rabbi Eliezer was strict with them in the way of Shammai, and Rabbi Yeshua accepted them kindly in the way of Hillel. And Rabbi Yeshua was Rabbi Eliezer's counterpart. He is Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya, the famous blacksmith who we learned about this past Sunday in the story of the argument with Rabbi Gamliel. He's the one that Rabbi Gamliel made stand, etc. So he yelled at the walls and he said, if the Talmidei Chacham are arguing with one another, what issue do you have over here? So they didn't continue falling out of respect for Rabbi Yeshua, and they didn't straighten out of respect to Rabbi Eliezer. And the Gemara says they're still standing there leaning. That's our Jewish Leaning Tower of Pisa. He said, if the halacha is like me, so the heavens will prove. And a heavenly voice came out and said, what are you guys arguing with Rabbi Eliezer for? The halacha is like him, everywhere. Rabbi Yeshua stood on his ground, stood on his feet, and said, God, you already told us in the Torah, Lo b'shamayim hi. The Torah is not in heavens. You gave it to the rabbis to decide what the halacha is. How we apply this is a machlokas Rambam Tosfos. Tosfos holds that a prophet can walk in and give halachic ruling. The Rambam holds that if a prophet gives halachic ruling, we put him to death. That's in violation of this. Lo b'shamayim hi, and a prophet, God would never send a prophecy telling us what the halacha is. A prophet can tell us, this is my tradition, this is how I learned, these are my proofs. The second he tries to bring prophecy to give halachic ruling, we put him to death. So the Torah has already been given at Sinai, and we don't listen to a bat kol, a heavenly voice. They decided and they put Rabbi Eliezer in Berchu le Rabbi Eliezer. They blessed Rabbi Eliezer. The Gemara says that Rav Natan once met up with Eliyahu and he asked him, what's God doing now? So he told, what was God doing at that hour? When he said one way and Rabbi Yeshua ruled the other way. So he said, God smiled and said, Nitzchuni banai, Nitzchuni banai. My sons have won me, my sons have won me. On that day they took all the purities that he purified and they burnt them in front of him and they came to account and they blessed him. Now what does it mean they blessed him? So here there's a big machlokas. Some say they put him in ostracism, they put him in cherem. And some say that no, that's why the Gemara used another Lashon. The Ramban is insistent, he brings proofs from all over. This wasn't the real Cherem. This was more like a lighter warning. They said, who could give him word? Rabbi Akiva said, I'll go. Because if someone else goes who's not fitting, so he'll be so upset he'll cause the world to be destroyed. Rabbi Akiva got dressed in black clothing. He wrapped himself with a black talis, sat before him at a distance of 4 amos. Now Rabbi Akiva was his disciple. That one time Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Shua were talking with Rabbi Akiva, and a child walked before them, and out of disrespect he took off his yarmulke. So Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Yoshua were his rabbis. One said, oh, he's from a mamzer. The other one said, no, he's from a nida. Rabbi Akiva said, no, he's both. So he said, how do you know? So he said, you'll check it out, you'll see I'm right. They checked it out, they said he was right. And that was the first case. That's the example of where Rabbi Akiva proved to outsmart his rabbis. And from there on, Rabbi Akiva reached that elevated stature. If you recall, Rabbi Akiva started off at the age of 40 not knowing anything. And he learned by Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Yeshua. They were his rabbim. And ultimately, he was so great that he was considered their equal. He attained that height. Rabbi Lezer, even though we're going to see now that Rabbi Lezer was disqualified, his halachic opinion was disqualified, and we don't accept him in halacha. From this point on, he's called Shamuti. He's the one that was distanced. He's the one that goes with the opinion of Shammai. We don't rule like Rabbi Lezer throughout the Shas. Nonetheless, his opinion shows up all the time, and his is the first opinion that Rabbi saw fit to tell us in the Mishnah. Shas Mishnais begins with Rabbi Eliezer. The first Mishnah, the first opinion is Rabbi Eliezer. And he's expressed throughout. Rabbi Eliezer, anytime we have Rabbi Eliezer in the Mishnah, Stam Rabbi Eliezer is Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkunus. And that's the Rabbi Eliezer that we learned about in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer. Oh, Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, that's Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkunus. He's the one that he was 27 years old and he hadn't learned the word. And he was plowing for his father, a wealthy person, Hurkunus, in his field. And he started crying. His father asked him, what do you want? He said, I want to learn Torah. He said, you're too old. Marry your wife. Your children will learn Torah. He said, no, I want to learn. And finally, he ran away. And he came to Yerushalayim, to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and started crying before him. The Medrash says that when he was crying in the field, Eliyahu showed up to him and asked him and told him, if you want to learn Torah, after 2 weeks crying in the field, Eliyahu showed up and said, go up to Jerusalem, turn by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. When he showed up to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked him, what are you crying for? He said, I want to learn Torah. So he said, do you know Kriyat Shema? So he said, no. So he told him Kriyat Shema. He said, do you know how to bench? He said, no. So he taught him how to bench. So then he said, okay, I taught you Torah. So Rabbi Eliezer started crying. So he said, what are you crying for? So he said, you're talking about a 27-year-old man. He said, I want to learn Torah. So he said, okay, if you want to learn, so come to me each day, I'll teach you 2 halachos. And each day Rabbi Eliezer would come and he'd teach him 2 halachos and he'd review it and review it and review it. And eventually he became big Talmud Chacham. He was staying by Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananiah. This Rabbi Yoshua, who ultimately ruled against him, he was the one who took him in. He was his host. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai assumed that Rabbi Yeshua was giving him teeth. Rabbi Yeshua assumed that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was giving him teeth. And in the meantime, he was eating grass. He was eating hay. He was eating whatever he could find. So one day he comes to learn by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and his breath smells very bad. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai takes a few steps back. So Rabbi Eliezer started crying. So he asked him, what are you crying for? So he said, you're treating me like a mukeshchin, like a disgusting person who's covered with boils. You're distancing yourself from me like who knows what. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai blessed him. He said, "Ni kishem shirechto rech picha ala lefanai." Just as the smell from your mouth came up before me, so too the smell of Torah should go up before God from your mouth. And that blessing became true. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai sent word to Rabbi Yeshua to find out if Rabbi Yeshua was taking care of him, and then they realized that he hadn't been taken care of, and then they started taking care of him. Rabbi Lezer always took what his Rebbeim taught him. His Rebbe was the smallest disciple of Hillel. His Rebbe was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. When Hillel was lying on his deathbed, so Hillel gave word that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai should be the Nasi after him. It wasn't his son. His son only became Nasi later. His son was too young to be Nasi, so no one knew who would be Nasi. Hillel said, my smallest Talmud, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. But Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai hadn't only learned by Hillel, he had learned by Hillel and Shammai. And for some reason, when Rabbi Lezer became a rabbi, he took a lot of Shammai out of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And that's why we say he's Shamuti. Much of what he says, if not all of what he says, goes in line with Shammai. And Halacha is not like him. But now, Rabbi Akiva, who's his disciple, Rabbi Akiva says, I'm going to go and give him word, because if someone else goes, who knows what's going to happen. So he dresses in black, and he comes and sits before him at a distance of 4 amos. So Rabbi Lezer asked Rabbi Akiva, what's today different? Why are you distancing yourself from me? So Rabbi Akiva told him, Rabbi, kam dumari shechaverim derim imcha. I think that the rabbis are distancing themselves from you. And that's the way he hinted to him that they had decided to distance themselves from him. He tore his clothing, he took off his shoes, he sat on the floor and started crying. And a third of the olives were lost in the world, a third of the wheat, a third of the barley. Some say even all the dough that was being kneaded at that hour went sour. So the Rabbi Gamliel was coming in a ship and the wave came up and he was almost drowned. And he said, this must be because Rabbi Les ben Horkanos. He stood on his feet and he said, create master of the world. You know I didn't do this for my honor and not for my father's honor. I did it for your honor so that people, there won't be a lot of machlokas in Israel. And then the sea calmed down. Ima Shalom, Rabbi Lezer's wife, was the sister of Rabbi Gamliel. And from that day on, that's what we discussed today, she ensured that Rabbi Lezer would never do nefil sapayim. He would never fall for tachnun. She'd always interrupt him. And that's why people aren't careful about talking after Shmona Esrei, the sound Shmona Esrei. And from this Gemara, we see how important it is that there should be a continuum from our Shmona Esrei to Nefil Sapayim. If he would have had a continuum, which one day he did, that's what the Gemara says, one day she missed, she thought it was Rosh Chodesh, and it wasn't. And on that day, he did Nefil Sapayim straight after Shmona Esrei, and right away Rabbi Gamliel passed away. And that's why we brought this whole Gemara, that this is the... They asked her, how'd you know that you have to distract them from Nefil Sapayim? She said, the tradition I have from David, who's the forefather of our family, is that all the gates get sealed except for the gate of Ona'a, of affliction. And we'll end with the Tanai quote that if one has to be extra careful with a ger, the Gemara says there are extra lavim, three extra lavim about a ger. Okay, so we saw a quick overview of that story with all the introduction and the end of the story. We see that he didn't give in. If he would have just brought his halachic arguments and ended the argument there, so no one would have put him in cherem. The reason they put him in cherem was because after all the rabbis had come to account and everyone disagreed with him, he said, I'm sticking to my tradition and I'm not giving in. And the halacha is right like me. And then he started bringing all these extraordinary feats to prove his point. And the rabbi said, those things don't impress us. And the fact that you're maintaining you're right, even though everyone disagrees with you, and we've come to account, that's why they held it against him. Not because he disagreed. He is allowed to have an opinion. The Rav Henkin has a beautiful essay about this story in which he says that the disagreement between Rabbi Lezer and the rabbis was a disagreement as to how the Jews are to behave with regard to the governing power during the time of the destruction. And achnai literally means a snake. It's a type of a snake. And this was their code word for discussing how to deal with the Roman authorities at the time. And Rabbi Lezer said, Tohu, even though they're oppressing us, they're not the end of the world. We have to make peace with them and figure out how to live side by side with them. So they're not Jewish and they're not good, but they're Tohu. You can't say we have to go all out war against them. And all the rabbis disagreed with him, and the rabbis felt that they have to be unified in this front, and that's why Rabbi Akiva was representative in coming and telling Rabbi Lezer that the rabbis disagreed with him, because Rabbi Akiva was the main force behind saying that the rabbis should join Bar Kochva. And the rabbis were scared to even write this in the Talmud, Rav Henkin says. So they codified it, even in the Talmud. And Rav Henkin, this is part of an essay in which he describes that the rabbis also had to hide the fact that they had joined forces so strongly against the Romans, and that that's where all of Rabbi Akiva's disciples had died, and that's why they codified that. They don't expand on it. They say that 24,000 died, and they don't go into details in this period. And they died because they had joined Bar Kochva's forces. So the whole discussion here, he explains, is revolving around how do we treat the Roman Empire. And the rabbis all felt that we should fight them, we should join Bar Kochva, and Rabbi Lezer said no. And Rabbi Lezer was right, ultimately. But the majority won.
How can he go with the Shammai and say that, you know, they just not join, but deal, arrange yourself with the Romans? I don't think that Shammai would have ever thought that way, no?
Why? Why? the destruction was here. They were the ruling force. And one of the things the Gemara says in Ksuvos is, be careful, don't mess with the nations. That's why the policy that the state of Israel took in most of its wars, I think in all of its wars, that it was a defensive policy. It was even attacks were out of defense. That's basically the approach the Gemara tells us to take. We're not supposed to be expansive. We're not supposed to be attacking the other nations. Yeah.
Who's to say that maybe it would have been worse if they didn't rebel?
First of all, we see historically that when the rebellion started, so the Romans became more vicious against us. Historically, our rebellions were unsuccessful. The one exception that I can remember is the story of the Chashmonaim. But in the time of the first temple, every time we tried to rebel, and towards the end, when we were under the Assyrian Empire and then under Nebuchadnezzar, primarily under Nebuchadnezzar, our rebellions led to greater downfalls. We weren't ready for it. We weren't ready for it spiritually. I'm not talking about militarily. Over here, the heavenly decree was that we would be destroyed and scattered. We were in no position spiritually and also militarily to take on the Romans. When in fact we did, we lost. Who's to say? So it seems that Rabbi Akiva's backing of Bar Kokhba stemmed from the fact that Rabbi Akiva believed that he would be the Mashiach. That's how the Rambam explains it. And later on, Rabbi Akiva himself recognized that he had erred. Bar Kokhba was not the Mashiach. We had a whole class on this after the destruction of Gush Katif. So there were some rabbis who said it'll never happen and you don't have to worry, it's not going to happen. And so then we had a whole class discussing that Rambam, that the Rambam says that that rabbis, even a great rabbi like Rabbi Akiva, can make a mistake. When it comes to a question of making a political decision, so Rabbi Akiva analyzed the situation, did the best he could, and as great as Rabbi Akiva was, that we say the Torah could have been given by him, Moshe Rabbeinu saw him and said he should give the Torah and not me, at the end of the day he made a mistake. When it comes to practical things, one can, and sometimes advisable, to take the counsel of a rabbi, but one doesn't have to listen to him. One has to know that he can make a mistake. He's human. He's going to analyze things as best he can. Right, this was a political decision. Rabbi Akiva thought that Bar Kokhba would be the Mashiach. He made a mistake. The Rambam writes it. The Rambam writes, he made a mistake. Yeah.
So when do we know that we are spiritually prepared for? Because if you look on a plain sense on the history of the last 60 years, I wouldn't have thought even today that we were spiritually ready to conquer as Israel. It was totally secular. So why? Where is the spiritual readiness?
So who said we should have done it?
I don't. It's just a question.
No, so I think that
successful, and I don't believe that that the revolt, which should not be successful in the eyes of Hashem, will not be successful. Obviously, it was successful.
So we don't know how to gauge Hashem's decisions.
I just see what happens.
Okay, even when we just see, we don't know. We don't know how to gauge things. There was a big machlokas among the rabbis 60 years ago whether we should declare a state or shouldn't declare a state, which revolves around the Gemara and Ksuvos, about the promises that God said that we should not take on the nations, we shouldn't come back in a forceful fashion to the land of Israel. It's two different questions whether we should declare a state or what we should do now that the state exists. So whether we should have declared a state or not, so that depends on how you understand that Gemara. Some said yes, some said no. What our job is, so some say Rav Hirsch writes that our job is to be among the nations. Many people are very upset with Rav Hirsch because of that. Some say that Rav Hirsch changed his mind at the end of his days. Doesn't say it. His family members say that later on he became more Zionistic. Who knows? I don't know. They say it. I don't know of such a thing that he came back, but it's been quite a number of generations since then. We don't have to gauge as far as us. We have the Gemara, and that's the job of the leaders. They have to gauge what's right and what's wrong. And today, our gauge goes based upon halacha. In those days, the gauge was on a higher level. You had still Tanaim. There's a marked difference between this generation, which could take the Tanakh and derive halachas from the Tanakh, and the generation that follows it. We say there are 2,000 years of creation, 2,000 years of Torah. Those 2,000 years passed. Those 2,000 years of Torah were the 2,000 years of evolvement of Torah. From the time Torah was given till the end of this period, where the rabbis could take a new question that arose and derive from the Torah what the answer would be. Today, when we have a question, how do you keep Shabbos on the moon? We can't take a verse and derive from that verse what the halach is. We don't have that power. That power was lost between the Mishnah and the Gemara. You don't find the Gemara deriving new halachas from the verses. The Tanaim, Rabbi Akiva, was capable of doing that. They were on a level where they could look at the Psukim and derive from the Psukim the halachos. When we reached the stage of the Gemara, those 2,000 years were up. That was a new 2,000 years. That's 2,000 years of Gemara. It's the 2,000 years of the oral tradition. Today we expand on the oral tradition, but we can't expand on the Torah. We can't take from Torah and derive halacha. That's why many of the new questions we have today, we don't have answers for. If a woman is artificially inseminated and has two children, are they brothers or not? Are they her children? What about if we have a child, if we're going to clone a person? What about if there are many questions which... Right? So is that permitted? Whose child is that? Right? Right? So there's a set, there are three volumes, big volumes put out on this. There is response on it because we have to contend with it. It exists. But we cannot derive the answers the way we would like to from the verses in the Torah. We haven't been able to do that for the last 1,000 some odd years, almost 2,000 years now. So in Rabbi Akiva's time, they were still deriving things from verses. That's why I'm saying their analysis of where the Jewish people were holding and what God wanted them to do could come back from the Torah. And our generation, when we analyze it, we have to work with the Mishnah, with the Gemara, with the oral law, and figure out what we're supposed to do. But our analysis is going to be totally different than Rabbi Akiva's analysis. It was a different generation.
So why Rabbi Akiva was that high? Why couldn't he just by looking at Rabbi Bar Kokhba see that his Mishumi obviously does not fit the description of the Mashiach?
I don't know. I don't begin to know what it means that someone can see. I don't know what it means not to see. I don't know. Top.